To the radio at all over the past 40 years, you would have recognised at least some of those introductions as lead-ins to the distinctive, warm, resonant voice of Alan Dell. It's 40 years since Alan Dell, fresh out of the South African Broadcasting Corporation, joined the BBC. I'm Margaret Howard, and to celebrate that milestone of 40 years at the Beeb, I've been invited to shift Alan into the interviewee's chair and find out something about the man who's been involved in so many programmes. Congratulations on sticking it out for 40 years.
Sticking it out. Thank you very much, Margaret. It's nice to see you again.
What brought you to Britain from South Africa?
Well, I was in America studying acoustics at one of the record companies, and I was going to take it all back, the things I'd learned, to the SABC. But I came through London and stayed.
And then when you were in South Africa, was it music that got you into broadcasting?
Yes, it was. I was at school in Durban, and I used to listen to a band that was broadcasting from Johannesburg. And I was introduced to the band leader by someone else who, I was an aspiring piano player, clarinet player. And he said, I know that you like this band. Would you like to go down to the SABC and see it actually rehearsing? And it was a big orchestra at this time, 35-piece orchestra. And I went along. And the moment I walked into that studio, I knew that this was my life.
And so it has been.
Yes, it has.
Now, I don't want to worry you, but I've got hold of your contracts file.
Oh, heavens. Really?
Here it is. It's very large.
Yes, very large, but not much money.
We won't speak of the money,
All right. We
will speak of the programmes. The first one is August the 17th, 1953, called From My Top Shelf. Was that actually the first programme you did for the BBC?
Yes, it was. It was a trial program, which most new people did. I think it went out in the Home Service. And it was done because I had been introduced to the BBC by Eve Boswell. Now, she and I had worked together in South Africa. And she asked me to write four programs. And John Hooper was the BBC producer who was going to organize it. And through John Hooper, we did a pilot program, and then it was a long time before we did the actual transmission of these four programs that Eve had. So in the meantime, John had introduced me to Thurston Holland, who's an assistant to Anna Rinstone, and he said, would you like to do a record program? And I said, yes, please. And talking with John Hooper, as a matter of fact, I treasure a little recording of him reminiscing about me.
Along came Eve Boswell, and along with her came this very young man, Alan Dell. I thought immediately, what a big head. But very shortly afterwards, I realized he wasn't quite as big-headed as he looked. Underneath, he knew what he was talking about. And as soon as that was discovered, we got on like a house on fire. We did five programs for the Home Service. Alan wrote the scripts, did a very professional job on the announcing. The band was splendid, and I was even better up in the producer's box. But I learned a great deal from Alan in those days. I really mean it. He taught me a great deal about the art that I hadn't been able to learn here because nobody knew it. I think they were all too frightened of the Lord Reith image to experiment with different microphones and different layouts in studios. But But we started something way back in the very early 50s, which is still going on today.
Mm. I have very fond memories of that man. In fact, soon after that, he invited me to introduce the Ted Heath Band in the late night swing sessions. I mean, you know, here I was, a new boy, and I'm being asked to introduce the biggest, best band in the business. And actually, I had met Ted in 1953, before we did the series, because an independent producer in this country said to me, tell you what, hop down to the Rudolf Steiner Hall. We've got the Ted Heath Band in there. We're recording them for America. Go and produce a session. And I said, what? And I did. I've got one of those records still. It's never been done as a commercial record. That was Dennis Lotus, an old colleague of mine from South Africa, singing Walking My Baby Back Home.
It's great after being out late, walking my baby back home. Arm in arm over meadow and farm, walking my baby back home. We go along harmonizing a song, or I'm reciting a poem. Owls go by and they give me the eye, walking my baby back home. We stop for a while, she gives me a smile and snuggles her head to my chest. We start into bed, and that's when I get her powder all over my vest. After I kinda straighten my tie, she has to borrow my comb. One kiss, then I continue again, walking my baby back home. Walking my baby back home.
Dennis Lotus, Walking My Baby Back Home. Of course, I remember you as the great technician. When I came into the BBC in the late 50s, you were already a legend.
Really?
And I can remember walking into a studio in Portland Place, not in Broadcasting House, and they said, oh, don't touch any of this. It's all been set up specially for Alan Dell. And apparently you used to play your own records in, even in those days.
Yes.
You used to run round from the microphone into the other room that we call the cubicle and play your own records because you wouldn't trust anybody else to do it as precisely as you do.
Well, it was a complicated thing. I used to spend, well, on some of the programs, 30 hours working out how records could be mixed from one to the other. And you had to set them up and know exactly on what beat to cue this and how to mix it and so on. It was very complicated. You couldn't teach that to a studio manager in the rehearsal time that we had. And of course, it was all live in those days. You didn't put anything onto tape. We didn't have a tape machine in the studio.
Now then, you were not only a DJ in the BBC, you became a producer too.
Yes, what happened was that we go back to Anna Instern.
Anna Instern, of course, was the great lady of record programs when I came to the BBC.
Yes, she was the head of the gramophone department, in fact.
Careers stood or fell by what she said. She was law, wasn't she?
Oh, yes. She said to me one day, I'd like you to come on the staff on a, I think it was a 3-day contract to start with, because I want to do something with a morning program on Mondays. We've never had a vocal in the morning. All we've ever had was the sort of music while you work, instrumental things. She said it has to be very careful because if we upset the colonel down in Bristol, he'll cut himself shaving and we'll never hear the end of it. So I'd like you to record the Midland Light Orchestra, which at that time was conducted by Jack Coles. And then you can edit the music which comes down from Birmingham and slot in the records. And I had a little studio in Western House right at the top, and I went to work. But I was, literally, I used to introduce that 2.5-hour program with records, and that was the first time that vocals went out in the morning.
It's amazing to think of it now, isn't it, when you think of how many musical programs there are going out on the different networks.
Different.
But that was such an innovation.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Looking again at the file, I was rather surprised to discover, I don't know why I didn't realise before, that you were one of the people who did Housewife's Choice.
didn't everybody do housewives chores? I thought that one was invited to do it, I suppose.
Eamon Andrews did it, and Mrs. Elric's wee son, George.
Yes.
George
yes.
Elric.
Yes, right. Yes. I don't know who else. I think everybody else did. David Jacobs did it, and I can't think. Everybody who was presenting programs at that time.
Was it scripted, or did you ad-lib?
It was partly, because you used to get the cards, which came through from a department in the BBC who handed you all these cards and said, make something of that. And sometimes you made some notes, or sometimes you just read the cards, or whatever.
That was in 1955 you started Housewives Choice. Did you sort of feel that you'd arrived when you got to that? Because it was the big boys broadcasting league, wasn't it?
I don't know that I ever thought in those terms, Margaret. I never thought of arriving. I just did the job. No, that has never been me to think that I've come. The program comes first with me. It always has.
Well, what came after Housewives Choice was Pick of the Pops.
Now, isn't that amazing when you think of Fluff Freeman?
Yes.
What happened there was that in the, I think it was the latter part of 1955, somewhere, Franklin Engelman.
Jingle, we used to call
Jingle,
him.
Right. Presented a review of new records. And it didn't really work. I don't think the BBC was very happy with it. Now, I didn't know that. I got a call one day from a producer named Dennis Jones, who said to me, are you prepared to do an audition for a record program? Take some of the new singles and LP tracks, if you like. Because there were nice records being made at that time still. Good singers. And review them. Do half an hour and leave it open-ended as though you're going to carry on. And I did, and at the end of the audition, I said to him, what is this for? He said, well, it's for Pick of the Pops, actually. I said, who else has auditioned for this? He said, well, Sam Costa has, and so-and-so. I said, oh, well, I'm the new boy, I won't get it. But I did. I had the opportunity to review, as I say, nice singles that were coming out by old British artists like Ronnie Hilton and Dal McCurvin and so on, and the American people, and also LP tracks. And one of them that I remember particularly was Noel Tormey's Mountain Greenery, which came off an LP and became a hit. I played it 1 week and there was immediate response to it. And the record company phoned me up and said, would you like to choose something else from the LP and we'll issue it as a single? And that brought Noel Tormey to Britain for the first time.
On the 1st of May, it is moving day. Spring is here, so blow your job, throw your job away. Now's the time to trust to your wanderlust. In the city's dust you wait. Must you wait? Just you wait. In a mountain greenery where God paints the scenery just two crazy people together. Ha, 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 we love sequestering where no pests are pestering. No dear mama holds us in tether. Mosquitoes here won't bite you, dear. I let them sting me on the finger. Beans could get no keen reception in the beanery. Bless our mountain greenery, far from life's machinery. Bless our mountain greenery home. Mountain.
Looking at the file, on Boxing Day 1957, you did the Glenn Miller programme. That was a one-off. What was it exactly?
I haven't the faintest idea. I've done so many Glenn Miller programs over the years, Margaret. I think that probably the most important one in that whole series was the one in 1969, which I did. What happened was that it was the Home Service. They asked me to do a 45-minute Glenn Miller program because it was 25 years since he'd been lost. And I did it. It was a complicated program with all sorts of inserts of various people talking about Miller and so on. I had already planned to do a half-hour Miller series on the Light program going out on the Saturday afternoon. And between the time of the transmission of this program on the Home Service and the first of the Light program transmissions, I went down with flu terribly badly. And the doc said, no way you're going to go into a broadcasting house. Dennis Lewell had been appointed as the producer on this thing, and he said to me, what are we going to do if you're ill? And it was my wife who said, why don't you repeat the program that went out on the home service, because he's no way can he come in. He said, what a good idea. I'll cut it down to half an hour. And when he looked at it, he found that he couldn't cut it because it was so integrated that you just couldn't. So he said, don't worry about it. I'll ask Ray Moore, dear old Ray Moore, if he would mind if we pinched a quarter of an hour off him. And that's the way it started. And then I did three more programs, just half an hour each, but also with lots of interviews and things, which marked his 25 years. I don't remember 1957.
Do you remember 1958 when you started Roundabout? I was here then, and Roundabout was a very prestigious thing.
That was the beginning of quite a long series. We used to have a live thing in the studio. Dennis Wilson was on piano, and all sorts of people used to drop in. And it was
a lovely program.
Yes, it was. I enjoyed that.
I remember Richard Murdoch did it as well as you, I think.
Yes, I did one day, and other people came in later, and I can't remember.
I can remember listening to Dickie Murdoch doing it when there was the Princess Margaret scandal going on, and he had to read a newsflash that said, I would like it to be known that I have decided not to marry Group Captain Peter Townsend. I heard it on Roundabout.
There we are.
Now, we come to the fact that not only have you done things like Housewives' Choice and Pig of the Pops, but jazz as well.
Mm.
Now, there was Jazz Club. You did that for ages and ages.
Yes, that I enjoyed very much. We had lots of fun on that program, and I still have some recordings from various broadcasts that we did, and maybe we can slide one in here that will remind me and be nostalgic. All sorts of things happened on Jazz Club. Particularly, we had fun with people like Alex Welsh, who is gorgeous, and they used to make fun of me. And the band was touring Poland one year, and they brought back a chamber pot, a Poe, you see, and put it on my head in the middle of the broadcast. That's the sort of thing they got away with, I suppose. It wasn't television, thank goodness. I remember a certain party with pianist Eddie Thompson and his friend.
Well, this is it, ladies and gentlemen, the last Jazz Club of 1960. And having said that, you here and listeners at home know about it as much as I do about what's going on, because all the music that these boys are going to play tonight was worked out on rehearsal. They're all head arrangements. What I can do is introduce these gentlemen. This being Eddie Thompson's jazz party, we have Eddie Thompson at the piano. We'll keep it in. We also have Mr. Terry Lovelock on drums. Mr. Frank Donison on bass. And this great guitarist over here, Laurie Deneves. I see Diz Dizley's in the house. Keep away. Thank you. The front line, the guests, in fact, of this party are Mr. George Chisholm over here, this up-and-coming trombonist. Kenny Baker on trumpet. Mr. Bruce Turner on alto. And Jimmy the Skidlid on that thing, yeah. All right, you fellas ready? We're going to have a little bit of this tune called Moton Swing, if you're ready, gentlemen. Thank you.
assure you that Alan Dell hasn't got a chamber pot on his head. But he's going to tell us some more about Jazz Club.
Well, amongst the things that we did that I remember particularly was A Decade of Dankworth. Now, that was a live program from the Paris, and we sprung it on Johnny Dankworth in that he did not know what we were going to do. We obviously fixed the tunes. We had the old Dankworth claw band. We also had the big band on stage, and he didn't know, but we did a This Is Your Life on him. We brought in all sorts of people, and he was flabbergasted to find all these people who were going to talk about him and what he'd done in his 10 years as a band leader. That was something that I remember very well. Also, out of Jazz Club came the Bewley Jazz Festival, which I did for Lord Montague down at Palace House. And that was a disaster to begin with, because it was a three-day festival. I went down and I had lunch with Lord Montague, and while I was having lunch, I saw these gentlemen walking past with flagons of what was scrumpy on their shoulders. And I said to Lord Montague, "I don't fancy all that lot." And he said, "Oh, don't worry about anything." That evening we started. Now, it was a television show to begin with. And we had cameras on the lawn, and we had a scaffolding at the side of the bandstand with big lights on it. And suddenly these chaps were climbing up the scaffolding, which was rocking very alarmingly. And I thought it was going to come down on the stand, and I stopped Johnny Dankworth, as a matter of fact, and said, "We don't play another note until all of you come down." But that was only temporary, because the moment the actual television thing started, they were on the stage. I think something like 13 or 14 microphones disappeared into the lake. I was without a microphone in the end, and I just walked over to one of the guys who was on a Mole Richardson crane, you know, one of those arms which the camera's on the end of it, and he was using this to knock people off the stage. Literally.
Full of scrumpy.
Obviously. They jumped, they wrecked the stage and all the grand pianos and everything, and I said to Terry Hennebury, "That's it, I'm going home." And he said, "Well, hang about, come back in the morning and see what happens." And the lawn was covered in glass. I've never seen anything like it. It was a crumpled mess. But people put it together, and we did the second show that afternoon and another television show, which was wonderful.
So it wasn't only in recent years that we've had riots at pop concerts.
No. That was something that I will never forget. I've got some pictures of it somewhere. Frightening. You know that about that time I did a thing called Kings of the Keyboard. I remember.
Now that was a live show that you did from Broadcasting House with live music?
Yes, it was four grand pianos on the stage. It was done from the concert hall here in Broadcasting House. And they used to have a classical pianist, piano duettist like Ravitch and Landau, and a jazz piano player. And I can remember, it was originated by GOS.
General Overseas Service, which is now the World Service.
That's right. And they used to send an announcer up from Bush House to do the opening announcement. All he had to say were four words, Kings of the Keyboard. And this announcer arrived this particular day and said, "Is that all I've got to do? Really? Just these four words? They sent me from Bush. I'm not going to do it." "Oh." He said, "All right, when is it?" I said, "When the red light goes on, you say it." And he said, "Right." The red light went on, and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, Keys of the Keyboard." And none of us could continue. The audience fell about, and the pianist fumbled.
It's like people saying the British Broadcorping castration. That was that was very popular with some announcers.
That's right.
But I was an announcer at Bush House too, so I can remember coming over to do just the odd stray announcement like that. But when your big moment comes like that, and you've only got one short thing to do, it's terribly easy to fumble it.
As this chap did.
I want to draw you away just a moment from the BBC career, because there was a period when you worked for Capitol Records, when that was a very up-and-coming and dynamic company. Were you there as a producer?
No, that, in fact, was when I first went to Capitol in 1952. I was there for most of that year. And I was really studying how they achieved the sound that they did, because Capitol to me at that time was producing a sound which no other company was doing. And they had so many great artists like Nat King Cole and Joe Stafford and you name them, all the big ones. And I wanted to know how they achieved that sound. And of course I discovered it And that was the construction of the studio, which was the interesting thing. They also had an echo chamber, which nobody ever saw. It was a secret echo chamber, and it was wonderful. I worked there purely and simply. I was under the wing of the chief producer, Lee Gillette, and he showed me what he could show me, and it was wonderful to see the precision with which they worked, and it was marvelous, absolutely.
I had a feeling that that's where you must have learned to be the pro you are. Because you are so precise about what you do, and you do really like to get the mixes right and the entries right and so on.
Mm.
Was it at Capitol that you formed a relationship with Nelson Riddle for the first time?
More with Nat King Cole, actually, because, well, I was on some sessions that he did at Capitol, and later when he came to Britain, we re-met, and that was nice. I met Nelson for the first time then, but only in passing. He looked into a studio where I think Kay Starr or somebody was recording, and stuck his head round the door. I didn't know who he was. And he said to Lee Gillette, "I've got a great song for Nat." I thought he was a music publisher, you see. And he said, "Not now, not now. I'll talk with you later." And I didn't know until some years later when I met Nelson here in England. He came over. And we then began a friendship which lasted 25 years. Wonderful.
Well, perhaps we can break off there and hear a bit of Nat King Cole.
Yes, how about Unforgettable, which, I mean, is unforgettable, that.
With Nelson Riddle?
Yes, with Nelson Riddle, indeed. And this is how I introduced it on the obituary program.
For millions of people the world over, Nat King Cole's mark as a musician was made through hundreds of records, not least among them, this one.
Unforgettable. That's what you are. Unforgettable, though near or far, like a song of love that clings to me, how the thought of you does things to me, never before. Has someone been more unforgettable in every way? And forevermore, that's how you'll stay. That's why, darling, it's incredible that someone so unforgettable thinks that I am unforgettable too.
Nelson Riddle suggests to me Frank Sinatra, with whom you also had a long association.
I'd loved Sinatra from way back when he was on Columbia, even before that with Tommy Dorsey. And I first got to meet Sinatra in 1962 when he came here and did the Midnight Concert at the Festival Hall, and then did 3 days of recording at the old CTS studios in Bayswater. And I was happily invited to be one of the audience there. Bob Farnham was conducting and did the arrangements. And funnily enough, I sat with Nelson Riddle. He'd come over and he sat and listened to the sessions. Frank was very funny on those sessions. I thought he was marvelous. There was one occasion when he had the score, and he turned round to his valet, George, and said, "I wonder if I could get a music stand." And George jumped and produced an ordinary old music stand, put it down. Sinatra put the manuscript on the music stand and started to sing. Now, if you had rehearsed this and timed it in a movie, it couldn't have been better. That music stand hadn't been locked and started to sink. And Sinatra went down with it onto his knees. And nobody was playing the right notes. They were just watching this and wondering what was going to happen. Was he going to explode? And of course, he did it purposely. He got down and I think he said something like, I don't think this is the way to sing this song. And the place collapsed. It was wonderful.
It was with the Sinatra Dorsey project that you did that you won a Grammy in the United States and went to the States to collect it.
That's right. That was out of the blue. I don't always open my mail immediately. But this particular day, I opened the mail, and there at the bottom of the pile was this big white piece of paper. I turned it over, and it said, you've been invited to come to California and be nominated for a Grammy for the Sinatra Dorsey project. And I thought, oh, this is a gag from something. So I went through to my wife, Anne, and I said, I don't think this is real, but it's nice. And she said, I think it is real. Have a look at it. And sure enough, and I flew out on the Tuesday. The actual presentations were on the Wednesday. And I stayed with, not with Nelson Riddle, but he looked after us. And on the Wednesday, we went to the shrine. You start in the afternoon about 3 o'clock, all wearing evening dress and things. And you sit there for hours because of the East Coast, West Coast timings, you see. And when they came to this bit, they said, and the winner in this category of historical is the Dorsey Sinatra said, I couldn't believe it. But we had something nice to do.
So what was it exactly?
It was all the recordings, the 83 recordings that Frank Sinatra had done with the Dorsey Band. And nobody had ever done that as a package. We did it on 6 LPs here.
So you researched it and put it together?
Oh, yes. Yes, all of it. And wrote the sleeve notes for it and so on.
Sinatra now became the man whose LPs we girls all took to parties tucked under our arms.
And we fellas too. They were the great things. They set the whole pattern of the late 50s, 60s, didn't they?
What do you think it is about him that has that very special appeal, as you say, for men and women?
Well, he's a jazz musician by instinct. I don't think that he plays anything particular. But he knows so much about music instinctively. I've seen him directing the orchestra when we did the Bob Farnon sessions here. I've watched him direct the orchestra. And I've seen, well, I mean, he's conducted as well. And I asked Nelson Riddle about that. And he said, oh, he studies the charts terribly carefully. I mean, he conducted that beautiful album, The Man I Love, for Peggy Lee. And he did several other things.
This is my first affair, so please be kind. Handle my heart with care. Oh, please be kind. This is all.
Into the conversation, a mention of Anne, your wife.
Yes.
Now, did she come with you from South Africa, or did you meet her here?
I met her here. She was the assistant to the person who ran IBC Studios across the way here in Portland Place, 35 Portland Place. We continued to meet, as it were, and got married eventually.
Is that what prompted the move? Because looking again at the sturdy contracts file here, I see that you lived in Portland Place. Actually, down the road from here, number 24A, and then you moved to Kent.
Yes. Thank goodness I lived in 24A Portland Place, because I can remember when I was chipping the ceiling of paper one day, and the phone rang, And it was the lady who is now Steve Race's wife, Lonnie Mather, who was the SM in the BBC. And she said, "Hi, what are you doing?" And I said, "I'm chipping paper off the ceiling." And she said, "That's nice. I think you should be in the studio." I said, "What for?" She said, "You've got a broadcast in 20 minutes. And I said, "What?" And in paint-spattered trousers, I arrived in B4 studio and did the broadcast. Thank goodness, because 30 seconds from door to door.
You couldn't make it that fast from Kent.
Certainly not. Certainly not.
But anyway, you moved to Kent, and that was to have a family.
That's right. Well, in fact, we'd started the family in the flat here in Portland Place, and it was getting too small, obviously, for these additions which arrived. I don't know quite how, but they did. And I had a daughter, and then the son was about to appear, the first son. And so we moved to Kent, found a house, and we're still in the same house.
You wanted to bring them up in something that resembled the country. But when you were living in Portland Place, before you got married, that would have been the 50s. What was it like? What was a day here like at Broadcasting House? Because there were all sorts of characters around, weren't there? Dylan Thomas.
Oh, yes. Well, there's
Mrs. Dale, I remember.
She lived above me.
Did she?
That's right.
Luggy, we called her.
Yes, right.
Ellis Powell.
Yes.
Did you meet the poets who were falling about in the George down the road?
Not really. I did meet one of the producers who worked with them, one of the great producers, who was D.G. Bryson, Jeffrey Bryson. I was very grateful to him because here I was from the sticks, and a friend of mine who worked for United Nations Radio had done a documentary on UNESCO, and the BBC appointed a liaison producer, who was Jeffrey Bryson. And they called me in because Leo Genn was supposed to be the narrator of this thing, and he wasn't available at that time, but they needed to get things sorted out for timing. So they said, "Would you read the script?" So I said, "Fine." And I started to read the script. And about the second day, I noticed that D.G. Bryson was listening to me. And he walked across and he said, "Alan, that last sentence that you just read, have you thought of putting a pause at that point and giving that word an upward inflection?" And I said, "No." He said, "Try it." And I did. And he said, "That sounds better, doesn't it?" I said, "Yes, it does." He began to produce me, and I was just the stand-in guy, you know, filling in. And I'm grateful to that man because he certainly taught me something which has been useful, I guess, in phrasing and so on.
Now then, in the big fat file, we come to album time.
Can I go back before album time? I used to present a program on the Home Service with Ken Sikora. Do you remember Ken Sikora?
Oh,
played
yes.
Beautiful guitar, amongst other things. He and I co-presented a review of the new LPs, and it was called LP Parade. Eventually, because I was on the staff then, I took over the production of the thing and didn't do any more co-presenting with Ken. He did it all by himself. But that was the beginning of album time, or the forerunner of album time, which came along in the 60s, I think, somewhere. And that was quite fun. I didn't choose the signature tune, which was absolutely marvelous, I think, that Rubens Blues with Stan Kenton. I didn't choose it. Jack Dabbs chose it, and it was a great, great opener. It was, caught you for some reason. It was wonderful.
Yes, that's the sound that definitely speaks of you.
Oh, really?
Yes, it's one of your tunes. Now, the technology was changing as you were building your career in the BBC. I noticed in 1959 in Jazz Club, there's a mention of stereo. Must have been coming in just about then, I suppose.
Yes, I was still living in Portland Place when I was asked to do some experimental stereo broadcasts. Do you remember those? You used to use your television set as one speaker and your radio as the other. But I did mostly music things in those days. I can remember getting the first Ella Fitzgerald George and Ira Gershwin album. Nelson Riddle also did that. And in one place he used the same idea that he'd used in Songs for Swinging Lovers with I've Got You Under My Skin, where he builds the middle of the thing into a bigger and bigger and bigger sound. And I used the mono record of Ella Fitzgerald singing it up to that point, and at that point where he starts to build, I gradually mixed it into stereo. And it was wonderful to hear the sound just travel across. It was a wide, wide sound. So.
Most wonderful, marvelous, that you should care for me.
I was. I loved doing those sort of things with records. I remember Henry Mancini saying to me one day, I said to him, you wrote a tune called Lujon. And he said, that's right. And I said, you know that Sarah Vaughan recorded the same song as, I can't remember, it was something about Hot Summer Night or something. I said, it's the same tune. And he said, that's right. And words added to it. I said, you can actually put the two records together. He said, you're up to your tricks again, aren't you? And we did. I put the two records together, one on top of the other, and it works.
You can't stop meddling, can you, with the technology? How do you like CDs?
I like them very much. I have question marks about clinical sound on some things which are recorded digitally to begin with. Sometimes tend to be clinically cold. And I'm going back to lovely warm vinyls because, funnily, I must tell you, I was in Capitol again recently. I was over there just to observe a recording session. And I walked in, and there they had this massive orchestra, and they were recording. And I looked at it, and they were recording analog, which is the old-fashioned way. Then, when they've got that warm sound down, they'll put it into a digital.
So it really makes that much difference?
Yes, it depends. It depends how it's done.
Because there was a muddiness to vinyl, wasn't there?
Well, certain recordings, but certain companies didn't have any muddiness. The Sinatra things, which were recorded at Capitol from the 50s to the 60s, those 9 years that he spent there, are perfect. Nobody has bettered them, whether they be mono or stereo.
Of course, you specialise in playing muzzy old records in
yes,
the
I
dance
do.
Band days.
Yes, sometimes they're very muzzy, I'm afraid. But I try to clean them as best I can without going too far. I mean, if I were to use a Cedar process or Sonic Solutions or one of these processes that technology has thrown up, I could get absolutely clean and pristine clean recordings. But I think that's all right if you're going to make a CD or something which is going to be on the market. This is a broadcast, and you're talking to people who remember these things from when they first heard them or collected the records and so on. And a little bit of surface noise is something which is part of the scene. I remember on wind-up gramophones and things like that. I think that adds to the atmosphere of those recordings, don't you?
Yes, I think it does. And I think certainly the listeners you have to a program like that are almost like members of a club, aren't they?
Yes, I feel that, and that has been said before. But it's a great, great honour. I love it. And I spend a lot of time sorting out the records and searching for them.
Well, if you could take just one off the dusty shelf and de-click it and defuzz it a bit, what would you play?
Probably something by Jack Hilton. Yes, I've got to confess that when I first started the dance band days, it came out of a series that the BBC asked me to do, which was the Golden Age of British Dance Bands. That was in 1972, and the BBC was celebrating 50 years. And they said we ought to represent the dance bands, which became famous through the broadcasts that they did on the late night thing from 10:30 to midnight, or even the afternoon things which Jack Payne did and Henry Hall. So they said, would you do these 13 programs? And I said, yes, if you choose the bands. There were obvious ones like Jack Payne, Henry Hall and Ambrose and so on, Jack Hilton. And they chose 13 bands. And I was on my knees at the end, because they were documentaries, and I went out and recorded a speech from various people who remembered the band, all musicians who were in them and so on. Lovely Poggy Poggs, it was wonderful. He played every instrument in the band, and he was living down in Crooker in Somerset, and went down there to talk to him. He was so funny. We finished the series, and the BBC then received a lot of mail saying, that's very nice, but what about this band and that band, which you didn't do? And I think it was Mark White, who was then head of Radio 2, who said to me, would you like to do another series? And I said, no, not like that. And he said, well, when we can find some time, we'll see what we can come up with. Well, 8 months passed, and then he said, we've got 8 weeks in August and September 1973. Will you do some programs? And I said, look, 8 months. Can I ask them on the big band sound what they'd like to hear? The mail came in shoals, and so was launched the Dance Band Days, ostensibly for 8 weeks. And we've just done 1,000 programs, and 20 years have gone by. It's never been off the air. And it led, of course, to those lovely concerts which we did at the Royal Festival Hall live, when we represented the Dance Band Days with an ad hoc orchestra we put together. And we got some of the old artists back again, like Alan Breeze and people like that who came in. And I remember Bert Reed, who was the pianist with Ambrose and his orchestra, came in, especially from Malta.
You actually produced the last Bing Crosby recording, didn't you?
I didn't produce it. I was involved with it. Laurie Monk produced it, actually. Lovely man.
And what was he singing?
Oh, he sang all sorts of songs. Some of them were old. One I remember was one which Bing sang about his career.
I've sung about the birds and bees, the daffodillies and the shady trees. I've covered Mother Nature inside out. The old Ox Road, the old mill stream, sing you sinners and darn that green. Nothing that I haven't sung about. some songs of sacrifice. I even sung a few that offered good advice. I've covered each emotion, there's no doubt. Like a fine romance, learned to prove, pennies from heaven and love in bloom. Nothing that I haven't sung about. There's many a chorus I sang of Dolores. Remember Marquita and that sweet Rio Rita. There's Mary and Sally and Rose Mexicali. From Emmeline to Clementine, they all got equal time. Yes, musically I've been around. I really think I covered every single town. I've always been a vocal gadabout. From the Swanee River to Galloway Bay, Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe, nothing that I haven't sung about.
He was quite remarkable. There was a little story about that because we did the interview at the end of the recording session when he'd done the songs, and then we sat down and talked about them. And that went out on a BBC record called The Final Chapter. And I was standing talking to him after the recording, and I said to him, next year, members of the American Air Force are due to come to England again, and we always have a marvelous concert for them at Bassingbourne usually, and one of our big bands plays for them. Would you come over and take part in the concert? And he said, I'd love to do that. He said, all you need to do is get the organizers to drop me a note at home. And if I have to fly over in the Bombay of some B-15 or something, I'll come to the concert. I'll do it. But just get them to write to me. And of course, it never happened. That was a Tuesday. He was dead on the Friday.
What you're associated with now, most of all, is the big band sound. When did that start? I mean, there was a program called Big Band Sound.
I can tell you when we started it. We started in the summer of 1969, and I can tell you why I remember that particularly. As a result of doing an interview with Dick Haymes for a Be My Guest, I got to produce Dick Haymes on an LP in this country, and that was something which was quite historic for me. It was wonderful to work with this man and to have a beautiful big orchestra, and we spent 3 or 4 days putting it together. But it was over a period of time because he was ill in the middle of it, and I used to take his wife down to Midhurst in Sussex where he was at hospital, and I remember listening to the first of the big band sounds that I did on the way back from Midhurst in Sussex. I was listening to the recording that we'd done. So that's when that began. And, of course, that has continued since 1969 until this very day.
Another program that continues to this day is Sounds Easy. Now, that began in 1979.
That was a continuation, really, or at least something that I felt ought to happen. There was an area which was, I felt, being ignored, an area of listeners who had grown up with the quality singers like Sinatra and Peggy Lee and so on and so forth. And they weren't being catered for in one program. You could hear the odd Sinatra here or the odd Peggy Lee or Ella Fitzgerald in this or that program. So to have a concentrated hour, I felt was necessary, and I begged the BBC to do it. It followed on from things that I'd done in the past. One was called Session at Six, and then Date with a Disc, which went into 2 series. And that was done for a long time. It became a sort of a cult program with collectors, I discovered later. They used to listen to this avidly and say, these were the new records which were coming out of this artist or that artist. And I used to put them together in a sort of nice, I hope a nice way, and it went down. Sounds Easy has had its moments of mixes, if you like, when I remember doing one program where I said, welcome to Sounds Easy, and didn't speak again for 20 minutes.
But it's great to know that somebody's there, because it's a lonely life, isn't it, being a broadcaster, sitting there with your turntables and your headphones on?
Yes, I suppose so. I don't feel lonely, though. I don't know. I feel that you're sitting opposite me, or somebody's sitting opposite me, and I'm talking to them.
That's the voice in the ear that we all love to hear. Alan Dell, congratulations again on 40 years. And thank you for talking to us.
Oh, it's a great pleasure, Margaret. Thank you.